I want to welcome John Rapoport to the Saleri Report. This is part of our ongoing discussions of the change underway, including the new administration. Our title for this topic is, for this conversation, is Make America Great Again, Framing the Vision. John and I were talking about the possibility of doing a series of conversations, and he said, you know, you've got to step back and make clear what you're saying about performance metrics. So he agreed he would help me do that. So we're going to talk a little bit about the Make America Great vision, the people involved and how to think about them, and then talk about how we as either citizens or members of the independent media assess how they're doing and hold them accountable to performance. So with that, John, welcome to the Saleri Report.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to this.
Well, I wanted to start off with a story that I told. I told about something that happened to me in the 90s, and I published it in 2002, quite a while ago, and it was called Growing Up on an Island. I was sitting one day very frustrated with trying to we were trying to re-engineer things in Washington to make them much more results-oriented and efficient economically, and I was getting very frustrated, and I was looking at one of my partners who grew up on Montserrat, and suddenly I realized so many of the people that I worked with or had been my partners grew up on islands. And I said to him, I said, Ozzie, why do I always get into cahoots with people who grow up on islands? And he started to explain to me that when you're on an island, you see your world whole. You see the impact of your behavior on how the whole echo, you know, I always talk about a financial ecosystem, which is the full complexity of all the different people and organizations that make up the economy, and as opposed to the environmental ecosystem. And he said, you know, when you're an island, you see how everything's connected, and you see how your behavior results in positive or negative. And over time, you learn to behave in a way that produces the kind of economy and place you'd like to live in. And you learn to, you know, to prefer and get into cahoots with the people who behave that way. And everybody is responsible, is trained to be responsible to take care of the whole in very practical ways. And he said, you know, America's just a very big island, but it's so big that people don't see the connection between themselves and the whole. And he said it's the same for the planet, and that is a great part of what is going on. You know, everybody thinks they can take whatever they want, do whatever they want, and there's no ramification to them of behaving that way. And I introduced it to a story called Saleri and the Rise of the Rule of Law, which laid out my vision for how we could, and we're going to talk in the detail of what I mean by this, but how we could re-engineer government investment so it had a very positive result as opposed to a very negative result, which is what a lot of my work has been about writing about, which we'll get into in a second. But I think that's what we're going to talk about today. How do we look at what's going on in America and look at the, including what the administration is doing, and how do we hold them responsible to go from negative to positive? What does that mean, and how do you do it, particularly on the economics? And the other thing I wanted to mention when I started, two things. One is the administration is talking about a vision of Make America Great Again, and it was the theme of Trump's campaign. But obviously, as they go through the Electoral College, then inauguration, and get their different appointees confirmed, we're going to see the specifics of what exactly that means. And of course, this is any vision is all in the details. That's number one. So we're talking to the extent we talk about the administration, we're talking about the specifics we know, which are still thin. The second thing is, Joseph and I did an interview called, The Trump Transition last week. And in it, I described both sort of the oligarchs and the establishment. I divided them into three groups. One was the pigs, you know, and those are the people who, you know, will take whatever they can get. One was the scaredy cats who are just, you know, putting their money in offshore havens and getting ready to take care of themselves when everything goes down. And the third I described as the Titanic turners, which is the guys who say, come on, let's get on the Titanic and turn it before it's too late. And I think a lot of what I'm interested in doing is seeing citizens and the independent media, and my first focus is the independent media, you know, give the pigs a really hard time, shame the scaredy cats, and then help the Titanic Turners. The danger being that if we empower the pigs and scare the scaredy cats, we're going to make it impossible for the Titanic Turners to get everything done. And as when you look at the independent media so far, they're having a hard time differentiating between who's who.
Yeah, I would say a tremendously hard time, because there are some people who you would say, okay, he's going to appoint this guy. I like what this guy is saying about X, but it's insane what he's saying about Y. So that's one factor. And another factor is, who does this guy that he's appointing represent? Is this some neocon interest about war, surveillance state, tightening, militarizing police forces? Or is this somebody that is genuinely standing for law and order, but not in some overpowering way? So there are all these questions that arise about these potential appointees.
Right. And the other problem we have is, if you look at these appointees, you know, it's fair to say that the president and the administration is not in control of the deep state. So clearly a faction of the deep state, there's been quite a struggle. And a faction of the deep state has sort of made their feelings known by having the Republicans elected. But the reality is, it's not as though these guys truly control the government. So they have to keep negotiating with the deep state, including because a lot of the organizations in the deep state control the day-to-day operations.
Yeah, like the State Department, for example.
Well, but think of it, that, you know, the whole financial operation is basically implemented and controlled and done by the New York Fed member banks and the big defense contractors. So the government doesn't have information sovereignty or financial sovereignty. And you've got an entire operational bureaucracy that, you know, you're dependent on a lot of these private companies and private banks to implement everything you're doing. So it's a little bit like, imagine if your bookkeeper and your banker and your biggest vendor was all your bank, and they controlled your accounts.
Yeah, that's quite a Titanic to turn around.
Right. Right. So, and that's why I say you want to, you know, one of the things I've always said is, when you have an 80% landslide, you can pretty much do whatever the deep state will let you do. If you only have a 48 or 49% vote behind you, you got to pick your fights. And so we're going to see Titanic Turners, you know, out of 10 fights, they figure they can do and win five, and they're going to let five slide, and that's going to frustrate us. So it's important to remember, you're looking at people who can do what they can do within the machinery. And one of the dangers here is, the really great people who go in, you know, they get so frustrated because everybody's criticizing them all the time and can't differentiate between them and the pigs, that they find themselves going along with the pigs because it's just easier, and you want to avoid that. Well, let's talk about money, because I think the important thing to understand about the change that we're looking at is, it's very much driven by the timing of what is happening, which has nothing to do with Republicans or Democrats. It has to do with the fact that we've lived in a world of both cheap money and, in fact, cheap natural resources, and the cheap money is coming to an end. So it's a little bit like, if you and I were buying houses and financing our home and buying cars and financing our home, and we've been paying 3%, and suddenly we woke up and we're in a world where we have to pay 20%, things are definitely going to change. We're going to have to live in a smaller house. You know, we're going to have one car instead of two, because our cost of capital just skyrocketed. And that means everybody and everything, you know, from you and I and how we use credit cards to how the federal government prints and borrows money is going to change, and it has a radical impact. So let's go through. You asked me to put together some definitions before we go into this so that we all share a common vocabulary. So I thought I would do that and just dive in and go through some definitions. But before I do, any thoughts?
Yes, well, what I'll do is, since I don't have a background in the nuts and the bolts of these terms or how they're really applied, when I don't understand something, I will just let you know, and we'll just keep breaking it down until,
okay,
you know, it's right there on the table.
Well, I really appreciate that, because one of the things I discovered working in Washington, you know, I had spent my whole life doing money, whether on Wall Street or Washington. You know, and I grew up in a world where, you know, everybody learned about money, and money was sort of the driving force. And it wasn't until I started to go into the litigation and work with reporters, I was working with all these really brilliant hotshot reporters, and I discovered they didn't understand Bo Peep about the financial system and economics and how that was impacting what they were researching. And what I discovered is, you know, the financial system has been made enormously, you know, 5,000 times more complicated than it needs to be. And that's purposeful. It's a way you control. You know, you make something just literally impossible to figure out and understand, and it's a control mechanism. So that's part of what we're going to have to overcome, and I really appreciate your helping me with it, because, you know, we're all struggling with the complexity of this. Okay, well, let's start off with bonds, because governments finance with bonds, and bond is basically, you know, you and I, if we were going to go borrow $1,000, we'd probably use our credit card. And if we borrowed $1,000 on our credit card, we'd have a $1,000 loan essentially from the credit card company. Well, bonds are just a way that people who borrow in large amounts essentially get a loan or an IOU. They issue a bond is an IOU, but it is treated as a security, which means you can buy and sell. So if I'm going to borrow $1,000 from you, but I do it in the form of a bond, you know, if you decide, okay, you lent me $1,000, but now you want that $1,000, you can turn around and sell it to somebody else and get your money. So it's literally just a loan or an IOU that is used when you're typically doing large amounts of money. So if you're borrowing, you know, say $10 to $1 billion, you tend to do bonds, whereas less than that, you tend to go to a bank or get a loan. And even less than that, you and I would go, you know, use a credit card company or get an advance or on our salary or something like that.
So you're saying that if I were to issue, if I, you know, had the power to issue a bond to you, then once I issue that bond, I or you have the right to sell that bond.
In most cases, most bonds are liquid. Not all. There are some which are not. Liquid means it can be transferred. And, well, that's what Wall Street does. They're an intermediary. And, of course, now you have these online systems that also let different bondholders, you know, trade with each other online. So if I
issue the bond to you, you become the bondholder?
Yes.
Or am I the bondholder?
If you issue the bond to me, I'm the buyer, you're the seller, and you're the issuer, and I'm the holder.
And then you can actually trade that or sell that, or
yes, I can borrow against it too. So to you, it's a debt. To me, it's an asset. It's a financial asset. So you have a financial liability. I have a financial asset.
Got it.
Right. And the way governments borrow typically is one, if they have a central bank that can print money, you print money, unless it's done through a debt form, which many of ours are. But governments issue bonds. So the U.S. government issues treasury bonds. Municipal governments issue municipal bonds. Corporations also issue bonds. They're called corporate bonds. And when you talk about, you know, ours are called treasury bonds, but if you talk about government bonds around the world, you'll hear the word sovereign bonds because it's issued by a sovereign government. And when we talk about how much debt has been issued, the amount that governments, you know, I talk about basically shifting from a model where governments own and operate everything to corporations. What we've been doing is we've been stripping government of its assets worldwide and then growing government's liabilities. So government is essentially, now we also see government turning around and in their pension funds and sovereign wealth funds and other pools of capital, you know, buying lots of bonds from other governments and buying stocks as well. So, but the amount of bonds that have been issued over the last 50 years have basically reached a point where the capacity, well, it was funny. I was in the City of London at an investment conference and one very staid British money manager got up and he said, "You better hope aliens exist because frankly, the US has borrowed all the capital on the planet and there's no place to go but off planet." Huh. I couldn't believe it. But it's fair to say that we have leveraged between bonds and other financial instruments. You know, we have borrowed tremendously against the future.
And this means the government has borrowed tremendously against the future.
Yes. Now corporations and individuals have borrowed much more. But the big issue when they talk about too much debt is that governments have borrowed. Now, legal arrangements are different in every place, but generally when a government borrows, that borrowing is collateralized by the obligation of the citizens of that sovereign government to make good. I'll never forget one entrepreneur in California after I explained all the money disappearing from the federal government. He gave an interview once and he said, "You know, I used to think I owned my house until I met Catherine Austin Fitz. And now I realize, looking at the debt of the government and how much money's been stolen, in fact, the creditors own my house." Because, in fact, we're on the hook, in theory, or under law, for that debt. It's real.
Okay, so when you say, for example, this is coming to an end, what you mean is, that despite what some people in government try to assure us of, that this endless borrowing of the federal government does have an end. It has a ceiling beyond which it really can't go, and we're pretty much there right now.
Well, that's an oversimplification, which is fine to do for purposes of, you know, creating a concept. The reality is we have reached the limit of borrowing it or printing it for almost free. And what I call the cost of capital is going up. So what is the cost of capital? Well, let's say you and I can borrow for our car loan and our house loan, our mortgage loan at 3%. But interest rates start to rise and it goes to 4 and then it goes to 5 and then it goes to 6 and it goes to 7. You know, that's a very different world. So one of the things that's happened in the United States, you know, we see the growth of tremendous inequality. And one is, you know, the people who are getting rich can borrow at 0% while we're borrowing on our credit cards for 30%. Now, you and I both know if you want to buy a house and the guy you're bidding against can borrow for 0% and you have to pay 30%, he's going to get the house. So our cost of capital is rising beyond a level where that can be justified by many of the uses of that money. So we need to talk about returns to get into that. But I would say that we're getting close to using up our debt capacity, and part of it depends on how long we remain the reserve currency. If you run the reserve currency, then you can basically print money for free and deficits don't matter because you're basically forcing the globe to subsidize them. But at some level of debt, it becomes more, you start to pay it goes from costing 0%, you know, and the cost starts to rise, which has a dramatic impact on what you can afford.
Okay.
And that includes on your existing debt, because suddenly you wake up, you know, it's like you get a credit card, you run up your credit card to $20,000, you're paying 3%, suddenly they jack the rates up to 20% on your existing debt.
Right.
So let me, before I go on to returns, let's talk about equity. If you and I buy a home, and let's say we buy a home for $200,000, and, you know, the market goes up, housing prices go up, it's worth $300,000. And we decide to take money out, so we get a home equity loan or a mortgage for $200,000. So now we have a $300,000 house, we have a $200,000 mortgage, and we have $100,000 of equity in our home. So then let's say the prices collapse and the value of the house goes back, it goes down to $150,000. Well, now, instead of having equity, we have more debt than we can, you know, than the value of the house. We have a $200,000 mortgage, but our house is only worth $150,000. So our equity is now negative. So the equity is the value of your asset minus your debt. So I just described a house. If we have a company and the company, we start a company and we build it and we make a lot of money and we save the money and use it to buy land and real estate to put our office in, and we end up with assets of $1 million and debt of $200,000, then our equity is the assets minus the debt. And our equity can just be sort of what the equity, you know, that's sitting on the company balance sheet, or if we sell shares, stock in the company, you know, shareholders can share in or own all of that equity. And so sometimes people refer to equity as the equity value of the home or the company, but they can also be referring to the stock market value if that company is owned by public shareholders. So if you look at the average American's IRA or 401k or other retirement savings, a lot of it is bonds and stocks of governments and corporations. So they'll have corporate bonds, they'll have corporate stocks, and then they'll have the treasury bonds from the U.S. Treasury. It's a very common thing to be owned in an IRA. So then let's talk about returns, because it's really important when you look at the U.S. government, what's happening now, to understand the issues related to return on investment and cost of capital. But let's talk about it in a private context. Let's say you bought a mutual fund, which is a fund that invests in stocks or bonds or both. So it's a collection of securities, and you bought a mutual fund, and every year it went up 10%. So you put $1,000 in, and every year it went up 10%. So every year, if you wanted to, you could take out whatever you wanted, but you could take out that 10% and still have your $1,000. Okay? That, what we say is, it has a positive return on investment. Your return on investment is 10%, because you're getting, it's going up with dividends and capital gains every year by 10%. I can feel that uncomfortable feeling.
No.
I'm
with you.
Okay.
I'm with you.
Okay. So let's say every year it goes down. Every year it goes down 10%. Now, it'd probably be pretty logical that you or I, if it was going down 10% every year, would take it out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But let's say we didn't take it out. Every year, because we wanted to save, we put, so it would lose $100 every year because it's going down 10%. Every year we'd put another $100 in to try and keep it at $1,000. You know, after a while, we'd feel very, very drained, right?
Sure, right.
Right, okay. So when something has a positive return, it's very energizing because, you know, a dollar turns into $1.10 every year. When it's negative, a dollar turns into 90 cents, it's very draining.
Right.
That's very interesting. You can walk into a situation where there's a negative return and everybody says, oh, I feel very drained and nothing works and there's not enough money. But the problem is not that there's not enough money. The problem is it's organized to produce a negative return. And unless you change it to produce a positive return, everybody's going to keep feeling drained.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So let's talk about return on investment to taxpayers, because you can estimate, you know, it's really easy to calculate the return on investment on a stock or a bond or a company, because you can, it's very easy to measure the equity value of a company or the price at which you bought a stock and then what you get. Now, if you look at the return on investment to taxpayers, it gets more complicated. And it's harder to calculate, but it is possible to estimate it and think about it in that way.
Let me just interject for a second. So in other words, I as a taxpayer am now thinking about, okay, I pay this much tax every year. What am I getting for it in some
right.
context or another? What does it, you know, and I'm not even sure when I'm asking the question, you know, what that implies, but I am holding out some hope that by paying taxes, some benefit or other is accruing to me somehow. And in this fog, I'm hoping that's true, and it would be wonderful if I actually knew what the benefit was.
Right. So, for example, imagine you're on an island with 10 other people, and the island has no roads.
Mm-hmm.
And you get together and say, you know something? Let's all chip in and pay these two guys to build the roads for us.
Right.
And the question for you, right, the question for you is, are you better off chipping in and paying them to build the roads? Are you better off and just seeing what emerges naturally from the behavior of all of you? Are you better off keeping the money and, you know, building your own driveway yourself? That's really what it comes down to. Because when I pay a dollar in taxes, is the result that the government spends or invests it in a way that makes for a stronger economy? In other words, do they increase the pie by engineering those different spends and invests, or do they shrink the pie? In other words, if they just left the money in private hands, would we get a bigger pie, or would we get a bigger pie by saying, okay, government, you go do the infrastructure, you make sure we have working courts, you do these different functions.
Which are basically all the functions of this monster-sized government.
Many of them. There appear to be some others. And so the question is, you know, is the return on investment to taxpayers positive or negative? Now, it's interesting. You can't estimate return on investment to taxpayer unless you can look at performance of government investment by place. So companies tend to do functions and sectors, you know, so they do railroads and, you know, consumer products everywhere and, you know, stuff online, whereas governments are responsible for the health and well-being of places. And, you know, so America breaks down into 3,100 counties, and the roads break down to, you know, roads in 3,100 counties or that go through 3,100 counties. So governments are really in the business of place-based investment. And what's interesting is if you buy a corporate stock, every year you're required by law to get an annual report. But if you pay your taxes to the federal government, you don't get an annual report that shows you contiguous to the area that you vote for political representation what the return on investment to taxpayers was from the money you spent, which conceptually is relatively easy to do. And, you know, that information is some of the biggest secrets in America, because it is phenomenally important for a control mechanism. Anyway, at Hamilton Securities, when relational databases first came out, the price of putting together place-based financial disclosure for the federal and state and local government in very graphical, fun, interesting, intuitive ways became economically very attractive. And so we started to build a place-based database operation for the U.S. And what we discovered was that much of the positive return on investment to private companies came as a result of subsidy that had a deeply negative return on investment to taxpayers and, in fact, was shrinking the pie. So in other words, you know, you had private companies or private individuals getting richer and richer and richer in a way that hurt the environment and shrunk, you know, they shrunk your environmental ecosystem and your financial ecosystem. So you were basically liquidating your economy. That's why I used to call it the tapeworm. It was basically sucking wealth out of the economy and shrinking the pie.
Now, you're talking about monies collected from taxes, let's say, by the federal government, that they would then give to companies or corporations on contracts to perform certain services, make certain products, whatever, whatever. And you're saying, yeah, the corporations or the companies make out well on this, but as it turns out, when you look at the return for the taxpayer who sort of started the whole ball rolling, the return is decidedly negative.
Right. And so, for example, we see Trump yapping about how much Boeing is going to be paid to do new planes for Air Force One. And his quote is, you know, we want Boeing to make a lot of money, but not this much. And what he's saying is, you can do this function for a lot less, and you can do it in a way that Boeing can still make plenty of money. We, you know, we want to have positive returns. But he's saying, you know, your positive return is coming in a negative return to taxpayer. That's not okay. That's what he's saying.
Okay.
So, you know, and it's a perfect, what he's trying to do is infuse, you know, he's, if you look at the Clintons, they're people who, they're government people who grew up in a world where money was free. You know, so they act like money's free. He grew up in a world where, you know, if you're a real estate developer, you've got to attract money, you've got to perform on money. Money's a lot more expensive. And he's trying to infuse the culture with the notion that every dollar is important and we got to get the best deal for the dollar that we can. So, you know, he kept yapping about the fact that he spent $600 million on his campaign and Clinton spent $1.2 billion. And all during the campaign, he was complaining, saying, you know, we don't have to spend as much money on campaigns. And he was right. So he's trying to get that culture changed. And I'll tell you, John, there's no bigger job in America than, you know, changing that culture. And that's going to be a theme throughout the conversation we have today. So let me just introduce one more return, and that is, or two more returns. Total economic return. If we were to look at the whole financial ecosystem and say, okay, you know, say let's decide a group of investors and the government get together and they say we want to build a convention center. The question on that convention center is, will it really improve the gross product of that place? You know, so we talk about GNP. Will it make the GNP go up? Will it be good for the environment? Will it create jobs? You know, so in theory, what we're looking to do is take the total economic return and have it be positive in a way that increases return for investors, because you want the investors to make money. A lot of those investors are retirees who need returns. You want the return to the taxpayer, because if the government's going to issue the bonds that finance the convention center and they're going to be liable for the bonds, you want the money to not only create more jobs, which create more taxpayers, but it creates enough economic benefit to the government that they can pay the bonds off and more. And then finally, there's everybody else. And I call that the return to the network. So if you look at most financial ecosystems, they've got a return to investor, they've got a return to the taxpayer, and then they've got a return to the network, which is everybody else. And what you're looking for is the both and. So a positive four ways.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And if you look at what's going on right now, too often we have a positive return to investor and a negative to all the others. And the reason that is now hurting investors is because if the parasite liquidates the host, no more host to liquidate.
Right.
And, you know, so when I talk about, I went through with Joseph all the different, many of the different companies represented by the different portfolios or current executive responsibilities of the people going into the economic positions. And they're looking, you know, so Mnuchin is the vice chairman of ESL Investments, and they're the lead investor in Sears. Sears is going down. Or, you know, Trump and the Mormon folks came out of the casino business. The Mormons had big investments in Las Vegas. You know, I was out in Las Vegas for 5 days, and there's not enough middle class left in America to fill up those rooms. So you know, they have drained the host. And so the reason you need positive returns all way is so the investors can make money tomorrow and the next day and next year, et cetera. And, you know, the pigs have been too piggy. And now, you know, and now the party's over.
Before you go on, how about an example, a specific example, where the taxpayer is paying taxes, the federal government is taking that money and investing it, so to speak, or letting it out as contracts on some project, whatever it is, and the overall effect vis-a-vis the return is bad.
These are my favorite examples. Let me just dive in. So when I was at Hamilton Securities Group, we started, the Clinton administration was committed to doing welfare reform. And the HUD buildings that we were working with as the HUD financial advisor had tons of people who were basically going to get thrown off welfare, which meant they were sitting in a HUD home and they couldn't afford to basically, they had housing subsidies, but they couldn't afford to eat. And it was going to be an economic mess for HUD. So we said, look, you know, with a digital age upon us, we can teleport data servicing into these buildings, set up a learning center. I lobbied the government and got the definition changed on Section 8 housing so that the property owner could use the money to set up computer learning centers. Because I said, what these guys need to, you know, to support themselves is they need the skills, which are pretty easy for most people to learn. And what they need is to not have to commute because they have child care, they have elderly care responsibilities. So they HUD started a program called Neighborhood Networks. We said, okay, we're going to prototype. We got tons of data servicing. Our data servicing needs were exploding. And we started a program to teach data servicing. And we said to everybody, if you graduate, we guarantee that you will have a job in this company, and that job will have a contract good for 1 year. And if you perform, you know, it will grow. So everybody, it's amazing. You know, when you tell everybody they get a job if they graduate, it's amazing how everybody graduates. You know, our success rate was off the charts. Anyway, so we started this company, and here's what we discovered. So we dug in to the economics of the people who were getting off welfare. We had people who were on welfare and housing subsidies and food stamps. And what we discovered was that the average woman with 1.8 children in the Washington, D.C. area was costing the U.S. government $55,000 plus, and that I think that's a conservative estimate, to basically keep this person on government benefits. And that person was spending 35 hours a week dealing with the bureaucracy of managing their benefits. And within, for $10,000 to $25,000 in a relatively short period of time, we could teach them how to earn $18,000 to $25,000 being a a data servicer working, a data servicing worker, and they would then be paying taxes to DC and the federal government instead of costing $55,000 a year.
So the $55,000 a year would actually be wiped out entirely, and it would be replaced by $25,000, of which there would be some tax also paid?
$25,000 is what it would cost to train them. But frankly, you know, if you set it up properly, private people would pay the $25,000 to train them.
Mm-hmm.
So the government didn't have to do that. It's really funny. I took the whole plan. Once I understood the numbers, I took the whole plan to Bob Lytan when he was at OMB, and I showed him what we could do and how we could do it, and you could do it in every neighborhood in America. Because you have this great workforce that cannot, you know, they cannot commute. They've got elderly, they've got kids care, they've got elderly, you know, they need to do this. But with telecommunications, you know, at the time, let me keep going.
Sure.
Now, if you look at the food stamp program, 37 states, the last time I looked, were outsourcing their food stamp sort of payment service and technical and customer support to JP Morgan, who is teleporting the data servicing to Asia, where people were doing the data servicing and the customer support. So if you're on food stamps in 37 states and you call customer service, you get someone in India working for JP Morgan who's getting a markup, who's doing a job that if you were doing that job, you wouldn't need food stamps. So we're paying literally millions of people in the United States to not work when they could be doing the job that we're paying somebody in Asia. So let's say, you know, to pay somebody in America costs $20,000, to pay them in Asia costs $10,000. And, you know, so it's cheaper in Asia. You give JP Morgan a markup of $2,000, so now it's only $8,000 cheaper. But if we're paying somebody, to $55,000 a year, it's costing us to pay them to not work. It's a no-brainer. It's cheaper to bring it back.
Got it.
Right? So when Trump says make America, you know, America first, that's what he means. So we were spending in Tennessee 3 years ago when I did this analysis, $1 billion a year in food stamps to people who every time they had a customer service problem would talk to somebody in India doing a job they could do, or many of them could do.
Wow.
Okay. So that's what I call a negative return to taxpayers. Let me keep going. You have tons of small farms in Tennessee that were put out of business by food safety rules. They're, you know, you re-engineer the food safety rules to something infinitely more intelligent and sensible, and you're going to get, millions of small farms propping up and selling food locally. And so those people not only are not going to be on food stamps, but they're going to be eating much healthier, fresher food, and they're going to have jobs. But, of course, you've used the food safety rules to engineer the agricultural system into the big guys. And now they are taking their $1 billion of food stamps and going down to Walmart and buying food that has been shipped in from 2,000 miles away, which is making them sick. On our last food series with Harry Blaser, Francois Vecchio is arguably one of the greatest butchers in the world. I mean, a real global superstar, pointed out that Americans pay half what Europeans pay for their food, and Europeans pay half what Americans pay for their health care. So Europeans spend it on the front end, we spend it on the back end. But part of it is we literally wiped out small business and small farms, not because it's economic, but because we rigged both cost of capital and the regulations. Now remember, it's our tax dollars that are paying government to do this, to basically wipe out small farms, which is why a lot of people are sitting around without jobs. There would be much more jobs if we let those small businesses just compete fairly in the market. So let me keep going to my favorite example, which is prisons. And it took me many years to get to the point where I could explain this in a state of amusement.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Okay, so in 1996, when I was working on, oh, and I should say, you know, basically the whole place-based data and the Edgewood Technology Center all sort of got shut down or super controlled And it's a much funnier, longer story. But, clearly they did not want, they wanted people staying on welfare, not doing competitive data servicing from neighborhoods. I got on to prisons because I was doing the Edgewood Technology Center business, and we were growing it because we had tremendous data servicing needs. And a guy came to me and he said, well, you ought to do these in prisons. And I said, I don't want to do them in prisons. If people have jobs, what I discovered is $10 plus healthcare buys almost everybody out of dealing drugs. People who are dealing drugs need the income, but it's amazing how little income, will get them out of dealing drugs because they don't want to deal drugs. It's dangerous. So what I discovered, I started to look into prisons because, it was not politically acceptable to do this in neighborhoods, and it started to, instead, all the data servicing was that wasn't outsourced was swung into prisons. So I started to look into prisons, and what I discovered is that the General Accounting Office did a study in 1996 and said the all-in cost of one person being in federal, state, and local prison, including all construction costs, full bureaucracy, all costs that normally aren't in the cost estimates you read in the paper, was $154,000 a year per person for each prisoner. Because you've got a parole bureaucracy and a court bureaucracy, and it's unbelievably expensive. And for those who don't believe me, I've written an online book called Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, and it's all there. And there's more the documentation that goes into the hundreds of thousands of pages. It's all there. Anyway, so the military-industrial complex was appending a prison-industrial complex in the early 90s. That was the explosion of the prisons. And so when you put a person in prison who could be a taxpayer, you take somebody who could generate, $2,000 to $5,000 a year in tax money to someone who's costing the taxpayers $154,000 a year. So, in fact, I just wrote a letter for someone who was going to prison in California, and he was going to prison for credit card fraud. And if you look at how much, if they had just let him work under probation, he could have not only generated taxes but paid back all the victims. And instead, they were putting him in prison where it was going to cost you and me $154,000 a year plus, add-on inflation since 1996. So for every prisoner, there's a tax prisoner. And let me keep going. At the time when this started, John, the prison stocks of they had started private prison companies to build all these companies. And the private prison companies were trading on a per bed basis. So the more people you could round up and put in prison, the more beds you could fill, the more the stocks would go up. So if you could pass a law increasing mandatory sentences, all the prison stocks would go up because investors were anticipating more beds filled up. Okay. So we went from, I think, less than 1 million prisoners to 2.2 million prisoners. Now, if you just cost that out at the 1996 cost, you're talking about, $350 billion. If we had the same incarceration rate as Scandinavia, it would be 25 to 50 billion. You'd save $300 billion a year. But let me keep going, because what I explain in the Dylan Reed story is my old partners at Dylan Reed financed this private prison company and then flipped it, not that many years later. And I sat down and I calculated for the Dylan Reed investors. The chairman of Dylan Reed put in $100,000 in the early 90s, and when they pulled their money out, he made an $800,000 profit. So he got, eight times his money. And I calculated that 34 people had to go to prison for a long time to generate his profits. And the cost of that at the $154,000 was going to cost 340 people working their entire lives to pay the cost of those 34 people going to prison.
And him getting the $800,000.
Right. So for John Berkland to get his quick flip, 340 people had to work their entire lives to fund 34 people going to prison. If you look at all the Dylan Reed officers and directors investing, it was going to cost 11,523 lives, taxpayers' lives, to get 1,150 people going to prison for a long time.
Unbelievable.
So that's what I call a positive return to investors, a negative return to taxpayers, a negative return, a negative total economic return, and a negative return to network. Everybody's worse off except the investors.
Except the investors. Now, let me ask you this, because I want to shift a little bit here. Especially what you've been saying, let's say in the last 15 minutes, where you're talking about these examples of negative return. How much of what you're talking about do you think that Trump understands?
Here's, let me try to say this in a way that quantifies it. When we built a relational database operation, Hamilton Securities, that would allow me to simulate re-engineering this so that I could create positive returns all way and see what it would do. And I took my smartest guy, who was a Chinese, I'd hired him out of a PhD program at MIT, and I asked him to go simulate what could happen if we could get a positive all way. And it's a pretty complex job. He went off and he came back, and I looked at it and I said, no, that's impossible. It's too much. There's no way. And I kept telling him to go away. You know, I was very busy. And finally came back, and this guy was really terrific. His name was Henry Fan, and he'd been at Tiananmen Square. I mean, this was a guy who understood. And I looked at it and I said, okay, Henry's too smart, and he keeps telling me this is right. So I said, I got to take the time to look at it. So I went in and I looked at his analysis, and I went into a state of complete shock. Because what I discovered, if you look at the current wealth in the United States, John, it's 1% of what it could be. I mean, in a generation or two, we could literally multiply 100 times the wealth in this country if you were free to optimize. And I was just in a state of shock. And I've been laughing and giggling ever since. The reason, you know, everybody says, oh, she's too optimistic. Well, it's because once you understand that there's absolutely no reason for poverty. Now, you know, getting to that 100%, everybody has to act like an adult. It's an enormous cultural change. And that's where I ran into the black budget, because one of the reasons you're at 1% is 100% is because you need centralized control to deal with the black budget and the secrecy and the privilege that results from that. And so the question became, well, what's that about? And the reason I went down the black hole of the black budget and UFOs is, you know, if you look at 3,100 counties in America, one of the reasons you can't turn it around is you can't back the drug dealers out because they're financing Tony Soprano, because Tony Soprano is financing James Bond. And every time you cut off those cash flows, James Bond comes down on the head of the mothers. So you have to go there if what you care about, you know, is the day that the free cheap money runs out. So let's get back to Trump. I don't think that Trump necessarily understands the detail of some of the aspects that I talk about, but I think Trump is 100% clear on the opportunity I'm describing, and I think that Goldman Sachs is 100% clear on that opportunity, and I think Warren Buffett, who's one of the lead investors in Goldman Sachs, I am 100% certain is 100% clear, because he's got his whole operation lined up to take advantage of it. Now, before we all get excited about that, the danger is, depending on how you do it, if you let the pigs run that opportunity, you know, they're just going to do another round of piggy stealing and we're going to end up as feudal serfs.
I mean, when you say things like Goldman Sachs and Buffett understand this, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're in favor of it. It just means they understand that it could happen. I mean, it's in the realm of possibility, but it doesn't mean that they're for it.
Well, here's, if this is the single largest capital gains outside of warfare that I've ever seen in my life. I saw it in 96. I finally realized it in 96. Now, the reality is you can capitalize, you can take advantage of that capital gain in a way where the investors take everything. Now, you know, will it be as much as they can make if they're not pigs? No. But, you know, the few that see it and lead it, you know, they'll end up gazillionaires. So, you know, and their attitude is, what do I care about everybody else? I just care about me. So there's a way to operationalize it where the investors take everything, they're pigs, and, you know, and a few guys are, you know, believe they're permanently better off, but they live in a horrible world. So you can make a lot of money, you know, so let's go back to our construct of return on investment to investors, to taxpayers, to the network, and then the total economic return. You can operationalize that with return on a positive return on investment to investors and negative to everybody else. But you can also do it in a way that is positive four-way. And I believe the role of independent media is to make sure that it's four-way and we don't let the pigs have their way. Because if Goldman Sachs, Warren Buffett see it and operationalize it, but the independent media and municipal leaders and small business leaders and the average citizen doesn't see it, you know, we won't get the kind of positive total economic return we can get if everybody sees it. Because if everybody sees it and everybody moves into alignment to make it happen, it's going to be much bigger.
You know, I got to say a few things here because as we've been talking, the the importance of this, what you're saying here, is growing larger and larger in my mind. First of all, I agree entirely about the role of independent media because, as you and I and Joseph Farrell discussed a few weeks ago, there is an opportunity here. Because of the results of the election, Trump's rejection of the media in particular, and the fact that Hillary Clinton is not going to occupy the White House. And that opportunity, of course, it's not all, you know, fairways and greens. I mean, I'm not trying to make this into a big rainbow package here.
Right.
But there is an opportunity for solutions.
Yes.
If you want to simplify things, there is a crack in the system that's occurred.
Right.
And it isn't a phony crack, and it isn't, you know, they planned it this way just to tease us and then hit us over the head. And, you know, it isn't that. There's a genuine thing here that could happen. As always, you could say the odds are not in our favor, but who cares? There is this opportunity. And independent researchers, investigators, media people, citizens, everybody absolutely has to do whatever they can to take advantage of this opportunity. So that's number one. And number two, you've explained this now in the last hour in a way that I said this at the beginning, I don't understand the nuts and the bolts of this at all. Now I do understand some of the nuts and the bolts. Enough to say that you're the only person I know or who I've ever known who has this particular vast picture. So what I'm recommending to you is, regardless of this conversation, which is very illuminating, And regardless of the fact that I know you've explained this thousands of times already to people, now you have to keep explaining it.
Yeah.
New conversations, new writings, new this, new that, to go over it just the way, for example, I've gone over medical issues thousands of times, each time seeing some new, you know, angle by which to make it clear as to what's actually happening. Because this is absolutely fantastic.
The opportunity is unbelievable.
I mean, this, and I get it here. You taught return on investment in economic terms for all four aspects or sectors, so that we're not torpedoing the whole thing while attempting to supposedly make it work and all of that. This is absolutely phenomenal.
So, and here's the thing to understand. When I did those calculations in 96 and looked at the whole place-based opportunity, I didn't begin to know anything about the new technology that was available. So if you use that technology in a way which is pro-human to help productivity, you know, the numbers that Henry Fan and I came up with are nothing. You know, it could be much better. You know, so good, in fact, that I believe the debt doesn't have to be a problem whatsoever. Now, let me keep going, though, because let's look at this, you know, sort of in a gaming framework. One of the reasons that the independent media must do this is if you're a Titanic Turner, there's a whole bunch of stuff you can't talk about. You can't talk about the black budget. You can't talk about it's important for me to get the mob on board here. You know, you can't have an honest conversation. You really can't. Because so many of these things are not politically acceptable or politically fashionable. I mean, look at the times of the campaign that Trump, you know, brought up vaccines or Common Core and how bizwhack everybody went. So the Titanic Turners need someone to be the bad guy about the sensitive or unfashionable issues. That's number one. So the other thing is, the Titanic Turners need help policing and putting the pigs in a corner. Because if you're in government, it's hard to do. They're dangerous. You know, they kill people. They kill people's kids. They get control files. They don't play nice. And so one of the things you'll see, since the media, the alternative media or the independent media started commenting on the nominees, I can, you know, right now I watch them beating up on the Titanic Turners and ignoring the pigs. And that's very dangerous. You got to be able to differentiate. And finally, you know, the independent media is doing a lot of fear porn stuff that only encourages Titanic Turners to become scaredy cats and run. So it's really, really important that where we can, we give leverage to the Titanic Turners, and we also create a vision that will not only help them understand where to go and to, or to implement it, but to deal with the deep state in terms of getting leverage, because the deep state can be their problem too. It's not just the pigs. But the other thing is, if there's anybody who can put the pigs in the corner, it's us.
Right. Yeah, I would say that pretty well covers the waterfront here. I mean, you can't, look, I know enough people in independent media to know.
Right.
Everybody's playing their role. Everybody has a particular angle of perspective or point of view. And it isn't a question of trying to, you know, let's all talk about this and listen to what I have to say and so forth. That's not going to work as a sort of a round table independent media. But what you can do is to show other people in independent media that there's another way to look at this. And then they at least have a choice. And I've had this happen to me when I've, you know, just out of the blue in an interview brought up solutions, specific solutions. There's a kind of, like a deep exhale, like, holy mackerel, this guy just shifted the conversation from everything is bad, everything is screwed up, everything is terrible. We understand more about why it's terrible and who's behind it and what they're really trying to do, to all of a sudden, we have an opportunity, and here's a solution that could work and could be implemented tomorrow that would change things radically in a number of areas in the country. And at that point, people who are independent, who have their own point of view, will begin to see something different than they saw before.
Right.
And they'll begin to think, well, maybe, you know, maybe I have to look at this. Maybe I have to shift gears here. Maybe I have to start thinking in terms of what could happen here.
So let me give you an example. I have that one of the links to this will be the letter that I wrote to my congresswoman in March. I have a little Solari circle where everybody said, okay, let's try again. Write a letter to your congresswoman and we'll all send it to our congresswoman or congressman. And it's about place-based data, because this is something that the federal government can do that costs them nothing. And they have the internal infrastructure in every agency to put this together relatively quickly. You know, a lot can be done. Because what needs to happen, John, is both in the independent media, but every citizen, I need to be able to see the data, you know, for my place. I can't worry about the whole world, but if I can just see the government spending and credit issuance and regulation and other resources for the world that I walk around and live in, you know, my county or my congressional district, you know, then I can go to a town hall meeting and have a perfectly intelligent conversation. But the opportunity, you know, you can't, if you're going to change, if you're going to go to positive returns four-way, you got to do it one county at a time. You can't do it in Washington. It's every county's, you know, New York City, Brooklyn is different than where you live or where I live. So it's very much, so I came on to this. Can I tell one more story example?
Yeah, but let me just interject one thing again here. That's true what you're saying, but if somebody at the federal level with a whole lot of power decided that it would be a very good idea to have the data from all of these counties and all of these municipalities and so forth, that in itself could go a very long way toward turning the Titanic.
Oh, tremendously, because then, here's the thing, if you're a government official, so I would find neighborhoods where HUD was spending $250,000 to build public housing, and literally two blocks away, you could buy and rehab an FHA foreclosed property for $50,000. So for $250,000, you could get five homes instead of one. Now, one of the powers of this, of having that data, is if you get 20 small business people in the Chamber of Commerce or the Rotary coming in and saying, look, we can create, you know, instead of one house, we can create five, or one home, we can create five. Let us do that. You can't say, no, we refuse to do that. We want to spend five times more than we need. That's against the law. So you know, there are laws related to government money, but you need, so let me tell you a story. We had a software tool called Community Wizard that would do this, and it, you know, would make lots of pictures and graphicals so you could see things in very graphical, intuitive ways. So I had a partner, Dylan Reed, who'd built a capital markets floor at Morgan Stanley and then come over at Dylan Reed. He was Cuban, his name. He's another island guy. And he came over, and he was basically saying the federal government is hopeless. The military-industrial complex is out of control. There's no hope. So I told him about Cupid. Community Wizard, he said, it's stupid, it'll never work. I said, well, come look. So I got him in the boardroom, and I pulled it up. We had all these monitors, and I said, okay, Luis, where do you live? He said, I live in Bronxville in Westchester, New York. So I pulled up the sources and uses of all federal resources in Bronxville and started to play with it and show him. And the first item was, there was $4 million of flood insurance, and he started to scream in Spanish. That's ridiculous. That's correct. You know, I said, wait a minute, you know, what's the problem? He says, I've lived in Bronxville for 30 years. It's on a hill. There's never been a flood in Bronxville ever. Well, there's a lot of black budget games on the insurance. Anyway, so I ended up printing out everything on Bronxville that we had, giving him like a huge stack of papers. And the next day I had a conference call. He flew back to New York. I called, and he was busy, busy. He's always on time, but he was busy. I finally got through that afternoon. I said, Luis, we had a call at 10:30. He said, I've been on the phone with the deputy mayor of Bronxville for 4 hours. He said, I've gone through every one of these numbers line by line. He said, all this waste and corruption is going to stop. And he sounded just like Trump. I said, Luis, I thought you said it was hopeless. He said, that's before I had the numbers for my neighborhood. You know, because he knows the deputy mayor. He knows the town. He lives there. He knows what's up. So he can look at the numbers and they have meaning. So part of this is you have to get liquidity and change. And I'll tell you the other danger. So I'm at HUD and I'm finding all these neighborhood. Hamilton was doing the FHA financial advisory. So I found all these neighborhoods over the country where they're paying $250,000 for public housing, and you know we can do one home out of the FHA foreclosed property for $50,000 to $100,000. So I took it to the assistant of the person who ran that program at HUD, and I said, "Look, Mindy, here we go. We could create many, many more homes for what you're paying." And she looked at me, she turned bright red, and she said, "But how would we generate fees for our friends?" Now, here's the problem, John. Everyone is getting, you've got half the country deeply financially dependent on checks coming directly or, through a defense contractor or something, So the way we're doing it now is financing everybody's income this month. And so there needs to be a way, and if you talk about changing it, they all get scared.
Yeah.
They get scared that they're not going to be able to pay their mortgage, they're not going to be able to feed their kids, and that's legitimate. So part of this is you have to come up with a way of going into the invention room and saying, wait a minute, we need to find a way of changing this where the pie gets bigger, but everybody who's a productive member of society can move out and take advantage of that. So we need to deal with the complexity because, something? We all need to pay our mortgage. We all need to make sure our kids are safe.
Absolutely. That's another reason why I think, when Trump talks about Bank of America Great or America First or whatever, part of the rationality behind that, whether you want to attribute it to him or not, it doesn't really matter, is that instead of considering the entire planet all at once and saying, okay, we're now going to map out all the money flows for the entire planet, and then figure out the best way to handle it for the best of everybody who lives here, you're taking something that at least is smaller than the whole planet and thinking about it instead of the globalist idea, which is, no, you have to start from the biggest entity of all. And then as you investigate their agenda deeper and deeper, you discover, oh, this has nothing to do with the greatest good. This has to do with control. This has to do with limiting the amount of energy that can be produced,
right,
driving people further into dependence and poverty and so forth and so on, all under the rubric of a technological solution to the world's problems.
Right. They're shrinking the pie so they can control it.
Exactly.
Right. And what Trump... So this campaign, there are two factions within the deep state, if you will. One wanted to compost the United States to keep the empire going, and one wanted to compost empire to make sure the United States, was strong. So one was saying, let's keep composting places, whether it's Libya, Haiti, or your neighborhood or mine, to keep the empire going. And the other is saying, no, we got to rebuild the base. We can't afford, I'm not saying they're walking away from empire, but they're saying you can't afford, to do to the United States what you did to Libya or Haiti.
Right.
We need, if we're going to have real power, we got to have a base that's powerful. And again, if you look at all the portfolios of all these companies, by wiping out the middle class, yeah, they got rich on wiping out the middle class, but now the middle class is wiped out and now they're sucking wind.
Exactly.
Right. So there is an incredible opportunity, but the question is, you know, there are a lot of different ways we can mess it up. I'd like to talk about one more before we close, and that's what I call piratization. So there's an expression, privatization is when you take a government asset or operation and transfer some or all ownership and responsibility to the private sector. So the big mistake on private prison companies was, you know, you paid a whole lot of compromised academics to say, oh, you know, we ought to outsource this to private companies. Well, of course, it turned out to be much, much more expensive. But it was not what I call privatization. Privatization, let's say I have a building and the government owns it and we're going to sell it. Privatization is when I sell it for its market value. If instead I do a process where, you know, a building that's worth $1 million gets sold for $100,000 to my friends, that's not privatization. That's what I call piratization.
Right.
Okay. It's a deal that doesn't happen in market. So when we did the HUD loan sales, on the first big loan sale, OMB estimated the value of the portfolio if the government continued to service it at $240 million. And we had hired AT&T Bell Laboratories to use their optimization technology that they had developed to route telephone calls to calculate the bids, which would allow us to take bids from both the real estate market, the securities market, and the mortgage market, thus really putting three markets in competition that had never been in competition on things like this. And after the bid was over, I called the Inspector General's office to the audit team who'd been sort of reviewing our design book and helping us with the design of the thing. And I said to them, how much do you think we got? And they said, well, we think you did an incredible job, so you probably got $340. I said, no, we got $712. And there was a long, long pause. And the IG head of audit said, we've been getting fucked all along, haven't we? I said, yep. You have. Because we got the recovery rate from 35 to 70 on that first bid, and we eventually got it up to 100%. So, you know, what that meant was all those private guys who'd been getting that inside deal lost it. And of course, they were very irritated.
I'm sure they were.
Well, you know, it's real funny. Mike Eisenson from Harvard Endowment, when what we did is we published all the designs and, you know, it was very transparent. And I called him. He ran the real estate portfolio for the Harvard Endowment. I called him on some other topic and he picked up the phone and screamed, fuck you. He didn't even say hello. He just screamed, fuck you. And I said, Mike, hello. You know, he's a very mild-mannered guy. It was inconceivable to me he would do that. And he said, I hate this optimization model. And I said, why? And he said, because the only way I can win is by paying more than everybody else. I said, what's wrong with that? He said, well, I'm used to winning because I'm smarter than everybody else. I said, well, welcome to competition. Now, it was interesting because Harvard Endowment had tried to get me to start a company that did all their work for their big multifamily property company. And so I went to closing and they tried to renege on their deal at the closing and get 20% of my equity. And that wasn't part of the deal. So I walked. And the only reason I was representing Hunter doing these loan sales was because they had reneged. Funny how things turn out. So
yeah, funny that way, huh?
But that's an example of so the one of the dangers here is you bring the capital back and you leave it to the pigs and you go too fast, you do too much, you don't design it properly, and you end up with piratization instead of and the problem when you have piratization, you know, it messes up the market. Everybody knows.
Yeah, just in terms of what you've been saying, the return goes to some people, but not everywhere that it's supposed to go.
Right. And you're basically, you know, you're taking advantage of government, and it creates a very bad incentive and message to the market, because then everybody says, well, you know, the only way to be money, to make money with these guys is to be a pig.
Exactly.
You know, it sends out the wrong whistles to the dog, you know, the dog pack. So,
this is fantastic. This is, send so many flares up in the air, and I'm really hoping that the people that are hearing this are having the same experience. This is not only what Catherine is talking about here, which is in itself explosive and wonderful, but the ideas in your own head that will spin off of this naturally are very valuable, and you should write them down and seriously consider following up on them, because the ripples from this never quit.
Right, and that's why I'm such a nut about letting, you know, there are a lot of rules that are really putting the boot on small business, including equity capital. So, you know, it's really easy for a big company to sell stock. But John, in my neighborhood, I can, in a relatively short time, spend my entire net worth on illegal drugs. I can spend my entire net worth on the lottery. But if I try and buy shares in, you know, my neighbor's business, we'll both go to jail. So now I'm oversimplifying, but, you know, if I'm willing to spend a fortune on legal bills, I'm sure I can figure out a way to do it legally. But
yeah, right.
Essentially, you know, you need thousands of entrepreneurs and small business, millions, in fact, all over the country, seeing this opportunity and going to operationalize it, because that is what will create the jobs. Big companies aren't going to create the jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Automation's going to, if anything, take it the other way. So you've got to unleash small business. And the way you unleash small business is you help them see the opportunity. But they can see the opportunity if you don't turn the government money. There's one other thing I want to mention before we close, and that is the biggest disadvantage of you and me or a small business or entrepreneur up against the big guys is they're using illegal surveillance. In other words, we walk into a neighborhood, and I can't listen to my neighbor's telephone conversations and read his emails, but they can.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And so, you know, their intelligence, when I said the problem Trump and his players are going to have, you know, is the intelligence agencies and all sorts of other private parties going to be listening to all their, you know, they literally have to go, you know, downstairs in the bunker under the White House to have a private conversation, and even that might not work.
Mm-hmm.
So part of this is, who gets to hear what? And the playing field is very unlevel when it comes to intelligence. And that's why, you know, when the Department of Justice came in and stole Community Wizard, you know, when I got it back 6 years later out of court control, the most valuable pieces had disappeared forever.
Wow.
Yeah. So a year after they stole the whole thing, one of the counsel and foreign relations type came to said, you know, I'd like to have lunch. I get it to lunch. And they'd say, dear, we think it would be a great idea if you started Community Wizard again. And what I realized is, oh, now that they figured the whole thing out and understand it, they want me to run around to all the neighborhoods and get everybody to digitize their data so they can suck it up. And I looked at him and I said, no, I think it's too late. And since then, I've been telling everybody, you know, keep your data on your kitchen table in a big file. Be very paperful. So one of the things we have to think about as we move to operationalize, you know, is how as an entrepreneur, small business, you can start or engage in a conspiracy where the big guys are playing dirty on, you know, on surveillance and predatory practices.
That's a very good thought to begin with. Telling the truth is one way. Right. It helps a lot, because people can recognize that. And they say, whoa, this is an entrepreneur that I want to find out more about, because he or she is starting out by telling the truth. And that's attractive. So let's see what they have to offer.
Right. Okay, well, this has been a wonderful, I'm going to put up lots of links. So if people want to explore some more of the, you know, these examples or some of the, I've written up some of these examples. So there's a lot of stuff. But John, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to have this conversation, because if we can get this to the point where it's easily understood by many and they can integrate it with what you know or what Joseph knows, wow.
Yeah, wow. Thank you. Thank you. This has been truly illuminating.
Well, thank you, John. You have a great day.
You too.
Bye.